Okay, we are now recording audio. And with that, I'll kick it over to Alan to start off the evening.
Okay, good evening, everyone. So can you see my main slide?
Yep.
Good. So we start off with a couple, I think, of follow-ups to last week. And one of them is about electronic waste. And somebody told us that the Salvation Army, at least the Orleans depot, has bins in the back where you can drop off regular items, but you can also leave e-waste. But we're not sure if other Salvation Army locations do the same thing. I looked on their website briefly, and it kind of suggests that they do recycle lots of stuff like metal and electronics, so they probably do. But if somebody wants to check that out, it's another option. And the second one is a follow-up on the pop-up ads that were trying to sell McAfee, but it was a third party trying to promote sale of this antivirus software. And I think, Chris, you had some on this stuff?
Yeah, just that somebody emailed me, the person who had the McAfee pop-up, and he had done some more Googling on it, and he found at the Answers Forum at Microsoft, somebody had exactly the same pop-up. It was absolutely identical in the way that it looked. And it turned out that the solution to it was to uninstall something from the programs list called FA_RSS. And if you go to the next slide, Alan. The solution sort of points out one thing, that it's probably not a bad idea to document all the installed programs on your computer. And that way, if you have a problem, you might refer to that list and see if something somehow has gotten added to the program list that is maybe causing the problem, and you could uninstall it. Now, it won't help with truly malicious software, because truly malicious software is never going to add itself to the program list, and you're not going to find it that way. But this looks like it's sort of a shady company. It's they were obviously trying to evade detection by naming it as FA_RSS rather than McAfee for sale or something like that, that would allow people to see that, yes, this is a truly useless thing that I don't want on my computer. So they added it to the program list, so they can't be accused of really trying to hide things. But just the way they named it, to me, they're a shady sort of company. So that was the idea behind it, I guess, is just the if you document it, and then you can go on and find things later on. And I think Alan can take over now with the solution he found for documenting programs.
Yeah, I had a thought about how do you create this list of installed applications. And the way I've always done it is to go to the control panel, go to uninstall a program, and then take screenshots of the list. That's a bit of a clumsy way to do it. So I did some Googling, and I found what you actually do is you use an uninstaller program, because when you have an uninstaller, what it does is it lists all the installed programs that you might want to remove. And the one I chose is one that's recommended on a number of different sites, which I trust. It's called Geek Uninstall, and it's a standalone program, so you actually don't need to install it, you just run it. And when you run it, it immediately, almost instantly in fact, gives you a list of the installed software on your system, and it gives you the date that you installed it. And if you notice at the top, it's got a menu, file, action, etc. If you go to the file menu, then it has an export to HTML. So it's going to export a text file, which is browser compatible. So you can either read it in a word processor or a text editor, or you can actually display it, as I've done here, in a word processor. So you can easily get a textual listing of all the installed programs on your system. It's very quick, and it's very easy, and it's another one of these pieces of free software, which I really like free software. Always works very well. Okay, so the next one is a new product, I think, available from Microsoft, which Chris probably can talk about.
Yeah, I can't talk much about it other than the fact that I saw it announced yesterday as general availability. And so I thought there might be some people interested in it. And it's available on Android or iOS devices, so phones or iPads or things like that. And it's called the Microsoft Family Safety App. And Microsoft, you know, they think it's a wonderful thing, of course. And some of the highlights that came out of the blog posting that Microsoft posted on blogs.microsoft.com, they said to use it as a weekly activity report, as a conversation starter, so you can talk with the kids about where it is that they're actually going. You do have the ability to limit screen time for play and make more time for learning. They have what they call the ability to have healthy boundaries with web and search filters. One thing that I think is pretty cool is that you can have purchase request emails, and so these will come to you as the sort of head of the family. And so if you have kids that are buying in-app purchases, you can find out about this. And then this last one, I'm not sure I'm all that keen on that. Know where your family is when things start to open up. Obviously, it's a tracking app as well. So I guess it can be good, used for good or for evil. And so other than that, I have no personal experience with it. I just saw a general availability came out yesterday and thought I'd pass it on.
So, Chris, what do you think that purchase request email is? Does that mean that the app will send you an email before the guy actually takes your money?
I do not know.
Sounds unlikely.
Yeah. If anything, I suppose you'll find out immediately if a purchase is made. Ideally, yes, you could authorize purchases, but I don't know how it works or anything like that. So there is documentation available from Microsoft, and I'm not interested in the app, so I won't be investigating it.
Okay, so now we have a more general question. Somebody received a message about Motsua VPN. Does anyone know anything about it? So if you go to the Motsua VPN website, you'll find that it costs $5 US a month. It has hundreds of servers in 30 countries. No bandwidth restrictions. No logging of your network activity, Chris. You'll be glad to know. And a 30-day money-back guarantee, and that's all I know about it. So does anybody else have any information about Motsua VPN? Any other VPNs?
Just as a general comment, I think at US, $5 a month, there's a lot of other places out there that are, I mean, it's competitive pricing, I guess. You know, but there are a lot of other ones out there. Coming from Mozilla, I would have a tendency to trust them, just because the Mozilla organization has been around a long time. But yeah, I think they're just one of many.
And they'll be updating it every 3 days, just like Firefox, rather.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I've used two VPNs. I've tried a few others, but I couldn't get them to work properly. The two I've tried is the Nord VPN, which I don't remember the cost off the top of my head, but it's for a 5-device license. And it works fairly innocuously, but some websites like Costco or Amazon Kindle and a few others, Home Depot and that, don't play well with it. You have a hard time using those websites if you have the Nord VPN on. The other one I've used is Avast SecureLine, and I tried it a couple of years ago when it was, you know, you get a one-device license and it was fairly expensive, but it was fairly good, much better than Nord VPN, but I dumped it because of the ridiculous cost, and I recently started using it again, because it's now included free if you get their Avast Ultimate package. And I've got the Avast Ultimate 10 device package, which costs me about $140 a year Canadian, and that's for their antivirus, their hardware upkeep tool, and a bunch of other stuff. And but now the Avast Secure Line, you have to put an add-on into each of your web browsers for the web browser to work through it. It's not like NordVPN where it it's pretty transparent. With the Avast one, you actually have to link it to each browser that you have. And so if you use Chrome and Firefox and the Avast Secure browser and a couple others, that's like four or five things you gotta do for each device. And so if you're using it to the full 8, 9, 10 device limit, well, that's a lot of extra work to do. So I now that I'm aware of the Mozilla one, I might try it out just to see how it works compared to the other two.
In terms of just being able to try something out, I highly recommend TunnelBear. So TunnelBear.com. They have a free version that gives you 500 megabytes of browsing per month. And so it's not a huge amount, but it will allow you to really try it out and see if it does work with everything that you need it to. I'm looking at the pricing page right now, and they have it from $3.33 a month. That's US for unlimited secure browsing for 5 connected devices. So because they have the free version, I think it's a great one to try it. I've used it, and I had no problems at all with it. But I never went with the paid version because I didn't have that much need for a VPN. But that's just, for what it's worth, TunnelBear.com.
Oh, that was my question. And so the two things that came up were, one, Netflix apparently, I don't know, has some feature where no VPN can make it think you're in a different country, so I'm not sure about that. But the other issue, I was reading recently that even though many of the other ones say they're not tracking you, apparently they are, and they're selling the data, and so, I don't know, I just got a little nervous. I kind of trust Mozilla, but I don't know.
Yeah, we talked a little bit last month about, or last week, about the idea that there were some in Southeast Asia, in particular, there was a number of VPN companies that were actually, they had leaked a whole bunch of personal identifiable information on people. So it's certainly possible. So, yeah, you do want to trust your VPN provider for sure. And I don't have the magic bullet for how you go about making sure that you do trust your provider. But it is something to be concerned about.
Yeah, Bob Walker here again. You mentioned being able to use a VPN to look like you're coming from another country. And places like Netflix, they themselves don't really care if you're a Canadian trying to look like you're an American using the American Netflix with all its much better programming. But they get a lot of flack from the companies whose movies and shows and everything they license. So they've developed algorithms that can identify to a large extent whether you're using a VPN to get to their site, and if that identifies that you're using a VPN, they'll cut you off. That said, some of the VPN companies like NordVPN and Avast Secure Line use some technology to obfuscate that you're using a VPN, so they're less likely to get caught. So just for your information.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess we can probably move on then. The next question is a kind of a follow-up to what Chris was talking about last week, I think, having a second admin account. And somebody took his advice, created one, but now when he logs in as a secondary administrator, he can see all the programs, but he doesn't see the same data and the documents folder is empty. And why, as a second administrator, doesn't he see the same thing under his main login? And Chris knows the answer to this one.
Yeah, an admin account, any admin account that you create on your computer doesn't automatically get access to the same information as other accounts on the system, in particular things that are under your user profile. So documents, pictures, things like that, the settings that are specific in the registry for particular programs, those are isolated on a per user basis. And so just having an admin account doesn't automatically give you access to that information. As a matter of fact, if you try to access it as an admin, you'll get an error message saying that you don't have rights to that particular user's documents folder or anything like that. Any administrator can take ownership of anything in the file system. So they can, in effect, wrest control and access to any of those files. But Windows isn't designed to just allow willy-nilly one user, even an admin, to be able to access the files of another user. The main idea behind having that extra admin account is that if for some reason your account stops working and you can't even log into Windows to do anything, if you don't have another admin account, you're pretty much cooked. There's nothing you can do. You can reformat the hard drive and start over. But if you have another admin account, they can go in, they can create user accounts, so they can create a brand new user account if it's beyond repair, your normal account. They can take ownership of those files that are in your other account. And it may have the ability to do other repairs that'll get Windows back into an operable state. So the long and short really is that consider it to be a separate user that has its own documents, its own pictures, and things like that. But you don't normally use that account. Okay? It's only there for emergency purposes to be able to get in when you can't get in using your regular account. And you may be able to get files that were there and possibly repair it. If not, create a brand new user and continue on with the new user account.
And I think, Chris, it will probably have its own desktop too, right?
Yep.
Yeah, because I normally use a regular user account, but I have an admin account, and they have completely different desktops. I've never bothered to make them the same, but
yeah,
I can tell which account I'm using.
Yeah, and each application, especially applications that store their information in the user registry hive, you know, those settings will be unique to each user, including that admin account. So I don't expect that people are ever actually going to use that account except in an emergency.
Okay, so our next question is for all you gamers out there. This isn't me. What do I need for a gaming computer? A fast CPU, a good graphics card, two graphics cards, really fast internet so I can play online, lots of memory, SSDs. Who knows the answer to this one? Because I, other than all of the above, I have not a clue, I guess. Lots of cash?
Lots of money.
Yeah, lots of money is a big thing for sure. I know that when my son bought a gaming PC, he paid more for the graphics card than he paid for the rest of the computer in total. So a good graphics card is definitely something that you're going to want. Two graphics cards, probably not unless you're like a really high-end gamer. And you want to play super high frame rates and things like that. A lot of memory on the graphics card is probably a good thing too, like, you know, 6 or 8 gigs of RAM on the video card. If you want to just follow or watch videos on high-end gaming systems, check out Linus Tech Tips on YouTube. And Linus Sebastian, probably about half of his videos that he has in Linus Tech Tips is about gaming computers. And so he has, and he's not a snob about it. He definitely, if you want the top end, he has a lot of information there. But he also has videos on building budget gaming computers, you know, for, you know, what can you build in a gaming computer for $600? And, you know, it's not going to run rings around, you know, all the other gamers out there, but it may allow you to play the games with reasonable screen refreshes and things like that. And so he has a lot of information. So Linus Tech Tips on YouTube is one place that I would aim people. I'm not a gamer. So that's about the extent of my knowledge on gaming computers.
And those video tutorials, they're quite entertaining too.
Yeah, he's quite a lively guy.
So anybody else have any thoughts about gaming computers? I guess not. Okay, Chris, next.
Okay, yeah, we just got an email from the Ottawa Public Library yesterday, and they have finalized the list of upcoming webinars for the fall. We normally, in the fall period, in our in-person ones, we would probably have had about 30 or maybe more different presentations on. It looks like we're going to have 7 this fall, and that's it. So they're all on Mondays. Some of them are in the morning at 10 a.m. Some of them are in the afternoon at 4. And so there's the list. The library hasn't come back to me since I sent to them saying that, yeah, it looked good to us, but because we didn't suggest any changes, I presume this will be the final list. They will be going up on our website at opcug.ca/opl-presentations, and they will be going up on the OPL website as well. And you don't have to have a library card to register for any of these, so anybody in the world can partake in it. They are done over a webinar, and it's Eventbrite where the registrations will actually come from, which I think is the reason why they don't restrict them to only people with library cards, because it's through Eventbrite that the actual registration is going to occur. So full descriptions of those. We actually have 3 new presentations in there. We have Keeping Passwords Safe, I'm doing. Basic Photography Tips and Techniques. Linda, who's on the call tonight, is going to be doing that. And we also have a brand new one from Alan on make a blog or create a website for free. The others are repeat ones. But all are welcome to attend, and feel free to pass that on to anybody else you know that might like to attend those particular sessions. They tend to be one-hour sessions with possibly a little bit of overflow for Q&A afterwards and things like that, but the presentations are generally just under the hour.
And when you say register soon, what you really mean is they haven't actually been posted on our website yet.
That's right, or the Ottawa Public Library website yet. And so I expect within the next week or so, they will go up on the OPL website, which is ultimately where you'll have to begin the real registration. But I sent the information to Bridget to get the information up onto our website as well, with links to the Ottawa Public Library website.
Chris, it's Corrine. Are these recorded?
No, they won't be. The ones they did, this is a brand new world for them as well. And in the June sessions, they did record them, and they were translating and captioning them. And I don't know, they were saying it was going to be about a month before they would get posted. I haven't checked to see whether any of them have made it yet. But the cost of doing it, getting them up onto YouTube with translation and captioning, was cost prohibitive, mm-hmm. So these sessions are not going to be recorded going forward.
Okay, thank you.
So when you say translation, they were going to translate them into French?
Yes. Yeah, it'll be. I really encourage anybody who speaks French to check them out when they're on YouTube and see what the quality of the translation is. But apparently, it was horrendously expensive.
I should imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, our next slide is a computer that's looking for a good home. Now, all hold your breath because this is a spectacular machine. And here are the details. It's a Commodore 8032, dual floppy drives with 5 1/4 floppy disks. In store condition, I guess that means as new. All connector cables and printer adapters. We're not sure how it's being given away or being sold, but if you're interested, there is the gentleman's email to contact him.
I got the email on this one, and David sent it out of the blue. He's not a member or anything like that, but he finally decided that this ancient historical beast that he should let go, and he wants it to find a good home. And I asked him if he was looking to just give it away or if he was looking to make money on this, and he said he wasn't sure. And he thought, if anything, a nominal fee, but he is looking to find somebody to give it to who is a collector, who will consider this to be, you know, a collectible computer item. So I would pressure him to either give it or, you know, give him $20 or something like that. I certainly would not offer him more than maybe $100. From the point of view of what this thing is really worth, he actually sent me a web page of some website that has, you know, ancient computers listed, and they listed the current value of this computer, just the computer. I don't think it included the floppy drive, but the computer itself was valued at, I think, $20 to $100 or something like that. So, yeah, if you are interested, I would hit him up to get it. You'll give it a loving home for nothing. But if you are interested in giving him a little bit of money, I certainly wouldn't give him very much.
Bob Walker here. You can also offer to donate a certain amount of money to his favorite charity, so that way, you know, he gets it a good home and it benefits somebody.
That's a good idea.
Well, maybe Science and Tech would be interested in it.
Yeah, it could be, actually. I might send an email to David just suggesting that he contact the museum.
They have a big warehouse now.
That's true.
Yeah, Bob Walker here again. When we were back in the days when we were at the National Museum of Science and Technology and we had the recycle table, somebody left an Apple II computer in the original boxes because they couldn't get rid of it. And the rule at the time was if you left something on the recycle table and nobody picked it up by the end of the meeting, you were supposed to take it back. But whoever left it there disappeared. So I ended up having to take it home. And I tried various ways to unload it at garage sales or other things, and I ended up just taking it to one of these electronic recycling depots to get rid of it, because nobody really cared to have a computer that old, despite the fact it was original condition in the boxes and everything else. So, you know, what people perceive as incredible value of some of these old computers really isn't there, because especially the younger computer users, they want the fast gaming machines and everything else. So there's no very limited market for these.
I see Eldon just seconded the thought for Science and Tech. Natalie has a question. Is there a max number of participants? Is that for the library presentations?
I can answer for both, actually. I think the library, it's a huge number. So I think that they can handle something like 1,000 on the webinars. For our meetings, it's limited to 100.
We have our own Zoom account.
Yeah, we don't have the webinar edition.
Right, but we do have a limited capability on it. Okay, that's everything for the prepared deck. So anybody else have questions, comments, or items they'd like to share?
Alan, it's Corrine again. We recycled some electronic equipment this week, and we went to AIM, which is in the Merivale Business Park, and they actually gave some money for some of the components. It's a very small amount, but we took all of the devices that we had there, and they took them. We even had some old TVs, and they took them too. So just wanted to let everybody know.
That's AIM?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's part of Cohen. Cohen and Cohen.
All right, okay.
Yeah, it's a recycling place. Like, you can take metal there too. So that's where it is, yeah.
One caution I would have with a place like that is if they're giving you money, probably means that they are trying to sell as is as opposed to just melting things down or whatever. And if you do have a hard drive with any personal information on it, make sure you wipe that data before you give it to somebody like that.
Yeah.
That was one of the benefits of the Ontario, whatever that was, the electronic stewardship.
Yeah.
OAS was that they would actually wipe drives. They always cautioned you that you should do it, but they didn't just turn around and sell drives. So something to keep in mind. We have a comment from Natalie, and sometimes TV movie set designers look for old stuff working or not. Wonder if there are any in Ottawa. My cousin does that in Toronto. Anybody know that of anybody in Ottawa that's doing set design and things like that? Okay, if anybody thinks of anything, if you throw it in the chat, we'll have a record of that.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I recall in a few of the most recent Q&A sessions, there were some disparaging comments on Adobe Reader and suggestions for other free PDF applications that were better and much more secure and much more efficient and everything. But in my ignorance, I didn't know what the applications were, and now I'm setting up another computer. And I want to try something besides the Adobe thing. Alan, could you maybe suggest a couple?
Yeah. PDF Exchange Viewer is one. Foxit software, Natalie is saying that's a good one.
Yeah, I've used Foxit for many, many years. Quite happy with it.
Okay, thank you very much.
There are a couple of others, but I think either of those you'd be quite well served. If you want to wave the Canadian flag, I believe the one Alan mentioned is out of Vancouver. Am I right on that, Alan?
I think it might be, yes.
Yeah.
I think you're right, yeah. I did a review on it a number of years ago in the newsletter and Michelin follow-up with some other stuff, so there is information on it on our website somewhere.
Yeah, Bob Walker here again. I don't necessarily expect an answer right now. I was going to put this into the suggestion box for next week's session, but I've got 2 3-packs of Microsoft Office 2010, and that, you know, the support is running out for that in a while, but in the time I've had these 2 3-packs, I've gone through multiple computers, and I've uninstalled and installed and reinstalled and whatever, and now I'm trying to figure out which computers have which of the 2 licenses on it. And it doesn't seem when you go through and get to the about or anything, there's any licensing information available so you know which license you're using. Is there any way to check this, or is my best bet to get things sorted out just to uninstall it from everything and then reinstall it and keep track of what goes on what machines?
Alan, I believe you've used, what is it, Magic Jelly Bean?
Yeah, that's... That gives you license keys sometimes.
Yeah, Magic Jelly Bean is one app. There are a couple of apps out there that purport to be able to go into the wherever, usually the registry, and they will actually give you the license keys. Microsoft is pretty weird on some of their stuff, the way that they track or don't track license key installations. I think for Office, what it really comes down to is if you no longer use it on one computer, and you can go ahead and install it on another computer, and as long as the license key doesn't pop up coming from two different sources, it will never be flagged as being a violation. One of the places I ran into this was on some commercial licensing, and I wanted to follow proper licensing, and I said, well, you know, how do we go about, you know, if I want to move this from one computer to another? And there was sort of silence for a little bit, and I asked again, and they said, oh, just uninstall it and go, you go ahead and install it on another computer, which told me that, yeah, there's the uninstall doesn't talk to their licensing server and free up anything. So I think as long as you don't have it in use simultaneously on multiple computers, you'll never get flagged as being a pirate or anything like that.
Yeah, I've never tried Magic Jelly Bean, but I remember about 4 or 5 years ago, I had 3 or 4 CDs or DVDs of Microsoft Windows XP, and I tried what I was able to find on the internet at the time to try and find out what the license keys for these damn things were, and I never was able to get a usable key to reuse any of these CDs, but I'll try this Magic Jelly Bean and see what it comes up with.
Yeah, I've had some success with it for sure, and just trying to document some computers where I had, for various reasons, I had lots of license keys, but I just didn't know which computers had used which license key, and Magic Jelly Bean actually did sort out things for me.
I've had the same experience finding the license key for Windows. But I've also had exactly the opposite. I've had Jelly Bean pop up a license key that's got nothing to do with my machine, so I don't know where that one came from.
I've seen Magic Jelly Bean occasionally pick up something out of the BIOS as well as a regular license key on a computer where the person didn't realize that they actually had a BIOS-level key, and they went and installed a version of Windows with a license key, and Magic Jelly Bean actually reported both license keys.
Worth a try anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I try and keep my licensing legal these days, which is a big difference from way back in the days of DOS when I was very, very proud to have not a single copy of licensed software on my machine, operating system. So. Things have sort of gone around full circle.
I remember a member of the user group who I won't name who was very proud of having Windows FE free edition.
Okay, anything else, anybody? We've got a bunch of time. I've got a little presentation ready to go if nobody has anything else.
Hi, Alan. It's Corinne again. What, just for like the regular monthly group meetings instead of the Q&As, do you have a list of topics that you're going to cover starting in September?
Yes, it'll be on the website as far as we've got. The September one is certainly fixed. It's going to be Raspberry Pi.
Right.
And after that, I don't know. I'd have to check.
Okay. I was just wondering if, you know, to go ahead, like, to put some ideas in for future meetings, that's all.
Oh, for sure.
No, yep. Ideas, yep. Good.
And then, yeah. Okay. We're always looking for ideas.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Alan, why don't you give us a demo?
Okay, just 1 second. I just checked the... Yeah, it looks like the only one we have listed is September, so... Okay, so basically it's this one. I'll just have to go find it. Let me get out of that. Go into here. Call open the file. Here. Just bear with me. Here we go. Slideshow. Go.
Yep, we got it.
Okay. All right, so we've had quite a lot of discussion about different image editing systems, and I keep harping on this one called GIMP, which is an open source program. And I've used this for a number of years, mainly because it comes with a lot of Linux distributions. So when I first moved to Linux a number of years ago, GIMP was bundled with the distro. So I tried it, and it has some reputation as being very like Photoshop. In other words, quite complex and lots of commands and that kind of thing. So it's quite a powerful image editor, but it also has a lot of very simple features. So depending on what you want to do, it can be simple or it can be complex. So for example, supposing I had a picture of a couple of horses and I wanted to just pick their heads, I would do a crop the image. So here is here's GIMP loaded, and you can see it, if you've ever used Photoshop, it's a bit like Photoshop in that it's got lots of controls and all over the place, but it has a menu as well. And what we're interested in is this control in the top left-hand corner called Rectangle Select. I mean, that's obviously going to be the way that we're going to crop our image. And once we choose a control, then we get a number of options which are applicable to that particular tool that we've chosen. So this is where the complex bit comes in. We can play around with those in all kinds of different ways to do lots of different things. But basically, what we need to do is open up a file. So we go to the file menu up here, pull up the dialog box, and then I'm just going to pick this image here and open it. And I've got this picture of a bird sat on some kind of hydro pole. And I'd like to kind of crop that because I've got too much sky and hydro pole. So I'm going to use my image tool. And once I hit the rectangle select, you can probably see here I've got this rectangle on the screen here, which I can drag around as you normally do with these things. But I think also I've got this highlight button down here. Remember those controls that you can access? So if I click on the highlight button, then it kind of, it highlights what I selected and kind of dims the background. So I have a much clearer idea, I think, of what my rectangle is actually selecting. So that's fairly simple stuff. So I now just call up the image menu. So this is one of the problems with things like GIMP, is you have to know your way around the system. But eventually you find out that if you want to crop and resize images, then you go to this image tab. I go down to crop selection, I hit that, and bingo, I've got my image cropped as I wish. Right, so now I have to save it. And again, you'd think that normally you'd go to the file menu and you'd do a save as up here somewhere. But it turns out if you save as, what you do is you save it as a GIMP kind of project file. It's an XCF or something format file. But what I want is I want a JPEG or a PNG or a GIF or something like that. And if I want to save it as a JPEG or a PNG, then I have to export it. So I have to use the export as tab to save it in that file format. And once I do that, I can rename it. So this is going to be my cropped image. I've called it Crested Caracara because that's what this hawk is. And I'm going to save it as a JPEG file. So I tell it to export. And now, of course, it lets me choose, what kind of compression do you want and various things like that. So I think I've opted here for 90% compression. You can choose whatever you want. And of course you can set those. So now if I pull up this JPEG file in my image viewer, I'm using Fastone Image Viewer, which is another free open source, well free anyway, freeware image viewer. And you can see I've saved my crop image as a JPEG file. But remember, we've got all these tools. And one of the things we can do is we can be a little bit clever. Rather than just have a freehand rectangle as we draw it, we can click on this fixed aspect ratio control right here, and then we can set an aspect ratio over here rather, and I can set this aspect ratio as 480 by 640, which is the standard format for my camera, albeit a smaller version of it. And now if I drag the box here, then I get the rectangular image, but the size is, or the aspect ratio is fixed. So the height and weight, the height and width are now related to each other in this ratio. And the other thing you notice over here is that it has a couple of little controls here. I've got it set for portrait format. But if I chose this one over here, it would change to 640 by 480, and I'd have a landscape selection in order to do my cropping. So that's a little bit more complex than just a simple freehand rectangle. And of course, there are lots of other controls here, rounded corners and feathered edges and all kinds of wonderful things that you can play with. Now, supposing I need to be a bit more intense. So what I want to do here is I want to create this road sign. And if you remember, members anyway, when COVID came along, the board decided that we would take some antivirus measures and we would give a free membership for the year because we weren't holding meetings in the church anymore and things were a bit more difficult for people. We weren't giving the same level of service, so we thought we would give people a break. And I came up with this little graphic of an antivirus thing to use in the newsletter. Well, now what I want to do is I want to use that same graphic, but I want to create this road safety type sign, because one of the other things I'm involved with is a road safety organization, and we have a newsletter, and people write articles, and somebody was going to write this article on what effect could COVID have on road safety. And the theory there is traffic's going to be lighter, so there won't be as many crashes, but the roads will be emptier, so people will drive faster, so the crashes will be more severe. And, you know, so there's a lot of different things that unintended consequences, let's say, that you could see in the road safety picture. Anyway, what I want to do is use the graphic to create this sign. So my original virus graphic I took from the Center for Disease Control, I think it's called, CDC, in the U.S., and I just cut that out of one of their images. It's not copyright, so that's fine to do. And quite often when I do this kind of image build-up thing, I do it in PowerPoint because I've used PowerPoint for a long time, and I find it really easy to, you know, draw circles and lines and that kind of stuff. So I drew a circle, and I created a line, and I joined them together as an image so I can overlay them on top of that thing. And now I need a road sign. I'm not very good at drawing stuff, so I use free clip art, and I went to this website called clicker.com, and I typed in road sign, and I found the one I wanted, and I like this yellow one. So I take my road sign, and I paste in my virus, but there's a problem, because the CDC website was using a white background, and when I cut the image out, of course, I take part of the background with it. Well, that looks stupid on a yellow road sign, so I want to get rid of that white background. So how do we do that? Well, remember I told you that GIMP is quite complex, and there's all kinds of different tools. And a few years ago, I did this article in the newsletter talking about the intelligent scissors. And I had this picture of a statue of a ball. And so with the magic scissors, you click on the tool, and then you start highlighting points. And as you go along the ball and hit different points, then the contour, the line, the selection follows the points. And then if you jump from this one to this one, it's magic scissors, or intelligent scissors, right? So it knows that here's the black ball and here's the gray background. So it knows it's going to follow this contour. So then I go from this point to the tip of the horns, and it's fine. It follows the horns beautifully, but it kind of skips straight across here. So now I have to backtrack and fix this up and put some more points in so I can follow the contour more carefully. So now what am I going to do with this guy? I'm going to follow every little contour on all of these spikes on the coronavirus to mark out the thing with the magic scissors. I don't think so. I obviously need a different tool. And one of the beauties of GIMP is that there's lots of online help. So I Google and I say, how do I make a transparent background? And I find this guy's blog and he tells me exactly how to do it. So all I have to do is follow the bouncing ball or the magic steps. So he says, open your image. So I do that and select the area you want to make transparent using an appropriate selection tool. So what's the selection tool? Well, he suggests using this guy right here, which is the magic wand, or as they call it, the fuzzy select tool. So I click on the magic wand tool, click on my image, and you can probably see here that the magic wand has essentially done all the contouring for me, all the way around the thing. So now I follow the instructions again, and he says, go to the layer menu, go down to transparency, go to the layer menu item, go down to transparency, and click on add the alpha channel. So I do that, and then he says, go to the edit menu over here, and click on clear, which will make the thing that we've selected transparent. So we hit on clear, and now lo and behold, here's our main image, and the squares here mean that the background is now transparent. So again, I now save this image, and you remember I use the export as to save it as a JPEG file, and I save it as a virus. So now you can see that I've radically transformed the image. Here's the original, which I grabbed from the CDC website, and here's the version that we just created in GIMP, which has a transparent background. I mean, that's obvious. Well, it's obvious when you go back into PowerPoint and pull all these things together. Because now you can see as I drag my image onto the yellow background, there's no white space around it. So I've made a transparent image. So now I can just drag things on top of each other, and there we have it. So I don't think I would have been able to do that with any other tool. I mean, it's certainly very easy to do with GIMP. I consider that to be a very complex translation process, but it's done in, you know, two or three clicks. And it's free software. That's quite amazing. So there we have it. The GIMP is the GNU, which is one of these Linux things, right? If you don't know GNU, GNU is shorthand for GNU is not Unix, GNU. And it's one of those funny recursive, non-recursive things that these Linux guys tend to like. The image manipulation program, GIMP, and you'll find it at gimp.org. It's available for Linux, but it's also available for Windows. So I use the same image editor on both programs, both operating systems, rather.
Just one point of clarification, Alan. You said that you did the transparent background and then you saved it as a JPEG. You can't actually use JPEG because JPEG doesn't support transparent background. So PNG. PNG supports transparent background. So, yeah, it's great. Yeah, and programs that allow you to do things like that. As you say, it is a fairly complex operation and can make a real difference in your editing, for sure.
Maybe I could just comment that the Photoscape X, it's free software that I've demoed to OPCUG, and also I teach at the library lectures. It does this in way less clicks and way fewer menu drop-downs and things like that. So your cropping tool is right on your main menu. You just click on it. You drag things around to the aspect ratios you want. But the transparent background, it's really, really simple. It's literally two clicks and you're done. And so just so you know, there are options out there, both of which are free. So that's great.
Yeah, another thing that I'd like to point out about the GIMP is that there's tons of help available for it. So there's YouTube videos, there's text tutorials. You can go to, down to chapters, and like there's probably half a dozen books, physical books you can buy on various versions of the GIMP. So it is a complex piece of software, but there's lots and lots of help available out there for it.
One option that I have used is with Earthing View, when you save a PNG, you have the option to select a color as transparent. So you just save as normal, but just click on the background color and it saves as a transparent color. Very simple.
That'll work for a lot of cases, for sure, but there are some circumstances where you don't necessarily want it. Like in this case, Alan would have selected white. Well, potentially you could have some white that was in the middle of the virus as well that you wouldn't want to make transparent. So there are some advantages to using a program that may be more complex to use to accomplish the end goal, but may give you more control over your ability to do it as well. So, yeah, I've used that feature in Earth Review before, and when it suits the subject, for sure, it's real, real easy to use. That, I find, is one of the trickiest things about photo editing programs, is that you can get ones that are very simple, easy to use, and then all of a sudden I find I run into a roadblock, and I go, oh, but I can't do this. And so it's that balancing act of having something that is simple to use but has all of the tools you need to actually accomplish what you want to do.
One of the questions that's just been asked in the last little while ago in the chat was, has anybody been following this Capitol Hill discussion on the big boys of the IT world, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And Chris says that most places don't seem to think that anything would fundamentally change. Has anybody else been following that and has any opinions?
At first I didn't thought it had much merit, but I heard some examples that made me think a bit. That might not be such a bad idea. For some example, I heard Facebook acquiring Snapchat in a way that was not really competitive, but kind of forced. And their big, huge size gives me second thoughts of if it has merit or not.
Well, that was Instagram, and I tend to agree. They bought them to take them away as a competitor, really, is what their aim was. But the Federal Trade Commission, they reviewed it, and they decided that, there's nothing wrong with that. And it's that sort of thing that, especially coming out of the States, that I think most people are thinking that, there isn't going to be any fundamental changes. There's a lot of posturing going on in an election year, and but the idea that there's going to be any major changes to any of those four is you're dreaming in Technicolor.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. This is down in the States, and it's basically the Wild West down there in terms of antitrust laws and everything else. Even though the Americans started the whole antitrust thing well over 100 years ago. But if you go to Europe, the European Union has much, much stricter privacy laws and antitrust laws. And these same four companies tend to be held much more to account there than they are in the United States. And Canada just doesn't seem to care one way or another.
I guess my question is, why isn't Microsoft on the list?
Good question. I find also on the other side, it's true, it's very political. And one example I think that might be a good thing is that Twitter, being so big, it can now more or less stand up to the president. So being big has some advantages also.
You mean the president? You mean Twitler?
Something like that.
Okay, we're about at our time, so.
Oh, I just had a post from Natalie. I have Corel PaintShop Pro, powerful program. Very confusing to figure out how to find and use typical processes and options. Takes a while to get used to. If you find Corel PaintShop Pro confusing, don't go to the GIMP. It is way more confusing than Corel PaintShop Pro. I've used PaintShop Pro, and it's a very complex program as well. But a result of that is that it can do an awful lot. It is a very, very capable program. But yeah, it's got a fair learning curve to it. Any program that has that is a powerful program is going to have a fair learning curve to it.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. If your photo editing needs are quite simple, you know, basic cropping, rotating, and a few other relatively simple things, UrfanView is a good program. It's free, and Chris has done several presentations on UrfanView over the years to show how easy it is. But the flip side is that it does your basic stuff very easily, but it can't do any of the complex stuff. So it depends on what your individual needs are.
It's Windows 10 comes with a pretty good photo editor for basic stuff too. And if you dig a little deep into it, you realize there's a lot more fine tuning adjustments than it appears at the start. So if you have basic editing needs, it's sitting right on your PC.
The program that Linda uses, Photoscape X, I would highly encourage anybody who is interested in any sort of any level of photo editing, try it out, because the simple stuff is as simple as it gets. And it really isn't confusing, but it has a lot of room to grow in it.
Yeah, and I found it really fast to learn, and I didn't forget what I had learned when I did try something tricky, which is usually the downfall of some other programs for me, is if I learn something complex, I go back and have to relearn it. And that didn't happen. That's the only time it hasn't happened is with this Photoscape X program. It just seemed it was intuitive enough that I remembered it when I came back weeks later or something to it. And don't forget, I posted in your last newsletter that I will do one-on-ones with anybody to help them learn it, because it's tough if you don't have somebody kind of pointing things out to you, and I'll do it remotely to your computer with your permission using Quick Assist.
Okay, so I've got a slide there about the next tech cafe. Actually, we have a regular OPCUG meeting the week before that, I believe, so we'll have some information about that too. And don't forget that if you have any questions, comments, or things you want to share, please send them to us at the suggestion box. And I think that's it for us.
I think that's it. I don't see anything new in the chat window. So I'd like to 8:35, we should be cutting things off. So I'd like to thank everybody for attending, and I hope you found it useful, and please be sure to participate with your questions and suggestions.
And we'll see you next week.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, folks. Bye.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.